I'd like us to look at some words from the prophet Jeremiah in the book of Lamentations this morning. But before we look at these words, I want you to know that Jeremiah, when he wrote these words, had been and was experiencing pain and hardship and heartache, like some of you are here this morning. And he, even more so. I know that some of you here have been going through some pretty miserable experiences. I know that some of you have been dealing with one health problem after another for years, and that for years you've been constantly in physical discomfort and in and out of doctor offices and poked and prodded and medicated, and you are so weary of dealing with that. I know that some of you have lost a beloved spouse in death. I know that some of you feel like you're slowly watching a loved one be taken from you because of a health condition or a drug addiction or something like that. Some of you have not too long ago been through the turmoil of a divorce and the breaking apart of your family. Some of you feel trapped in a job, I know, and you dread going to work every morning, but you feel you have to make a living for yourself, for your family. Some of you have had your kids leave home, and you're worried about them, and you feel helpless to protect them anymore. Some of you, I know, have been pleading with God in prayer that He helps in certain ways, and you feel like God is not listening. And some of you are having financial problems. Some of you are suffering loneliness. Some of you have other problems that nobody else knows about. And I want you to know, first of all, that Jeremiah was there, and his world even bleaker when he wrote these words that we're going to look at. Jeremiah is often called the weeping prophet because he did a lot of weeping through his 40 or 50 years of ministry. God called Jeremiah when he was a young man, maybe between like 17 and 20, to be a prophet to the very sinful, stubborn people of Judah. He was given a job that he did not want to have. His job was, in essence, to expose the sinfulness of the people and to give them their last warning before God delivered them into the hands of the cruel Babylonians. And not only did God lay on Jeremiah the difficult task of preaching stuff that the people didn't want to hear, but God also laid on Jeremiah some very difficult prohibitions. God forbid Jeremiah to get married or have children to reinforce his message that the kids and the moms and dads of this nation are going to die, either by famine or disease or sword. And that's what he was to tell people when they asked him why he wouldn't take a wife. Because he'd lose her, and he wouldn't want to bring kids to suffer in this place. God also forbid Jeremiah from attending funerals and from attending parties. And these, you can imagine, these antisocial restrictions on Jeremiah, in addition to his unpopular message, made Jeremiah a social outcast, a loner. He had few, if any, friends. In Jeremiah chapter 11, I think it is, we learn that even his own family came to despise him because of his preaching. In Jeremiah chapter 20, Jeremiah says, "I have become a laughingstock all day long. Everyone mocks me." He also says in chapter 20, "I have heard the whispering of many." Often Jeremiah could hear people talking behind his back, whispering so that he couldn't hear them, but he knew they were talking about him and not saying good things. Have you ever had people do that to you? Whisper about you? It's miserable to be despised by people. Jeremiah faced constant rejection. One time later in his ministry, God told Jeremiah to write down on a scroll the words that he'd been preaching. And so he called for a scribe, one of the few good men left in the land, Baruch, and he dictated the words to Baruch, and Baruch wrote them on the scroll. And then because Jeremiah was not allowed in the temple, Jeremiah sent Baruch to the temple on a big assembly day to read the scroll to the public. And Baruch did so. And then eventually word got to the king about this scroll, and the scroll was brought before King Jehoiakim, and the scroll was read before the king. It was winter time, and the king was sitting by a fire, and when three or four columns of text of the scroll were read, the king just took out his knife and cut off that section of the scroll, wadded it up, and threw it in his fire. Three or more columns of text would be read, and he'd just cut it off and throw it in the fire until he had cut up and burned the entire scroll of Jeremiah. I think that'd be pretty rough on a preacher. To have folks read through your sermon outlines and then as they do so, just toss them in the fire. But Jeremiah faced constant rejection. Jeremiah was often told to shut up and often threatened. In Jeremiah chapter 12, it says that his hometown folks of Anathoth, the very people that he grew up among, actually said to Jeremiah, "Do not prophesy to us in the name of the Lord, or we will kill you." Multiple occasions, Jeremiah suffered beating and imprisonment. One time, the high priest, after having Jeremiah beaten, he had him put in what our versions translate as stocks. It literally reads, "that which distorts." Some instrument of punishment that would hold his body in a bent, crooked, very uncomfortable position. And he had him put in this thing in a public place so that other people could mock him and insult him while he endured the pain. Multiple times people made attempts to take Jeremiah's life. I think the most memorable occasion was when a group of government officials took Jeremiah to a cistern, a deep well shaped like a flask with a narrow neck at the surface so the water didn't evaporate, an empty well. It just had a few feet of mud or silt and slime at the bottom, and they dropped poor Jeremiah in there. And he sunk in the mud, and they left him for dead. And it was a foreigner that took pity on him and saved his life on that occasion. Can you imagine preaching for 40 years and constantly facing rejection and suffering all of that, and then not seeing any visible results to the work that you'd been doing? Just the wind. All right, back to Jeremiah. No visible results. Hardly ever, you know, a compliment on his sermon, let alone somebody responding to the invitation. He dedicated his whole life to preventing a certain devastation, and then he had to watch it happen. And the horrible things that Jeremiah saw, it would be surprising if he didn't have what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. Jeremiah had to watch the very thing that he dedicated his life to trying to prevent. He had to watch the wrath of God be poured out on his stubborn, sinful countrymen. He watched the Babylonians slaughter thousands. He was there in the city of Jerusalem when the Babylonians laid siege to the city, and he saw thousands, and he saw hundreds of little kids starving to death. He saw mothers boil their children and eat them. He saw a woman give birth, and people ate the afterbirth. He saw the Romans, or the Babylonians, eventually break down the wall of the city and come in and slaughter thousands more, and then put many in chains as captives, and before their eyes take all of their possessions and burn down their homes, and then march those people off to a foreign land they've never seen before. He watched them destroy the gorgeous temple. Everything that he cared about in the world was destroyed. And the book of Lamentations is a book of five poems written by Jeremiah to lament the destruction of Jerusalem. And tradition has it that Jeremiah was sitting in a cave on the hill of Golgotha, overlooking the rubble of the once glorious city, smelling the stench of decaying bodies, seeing a few poor starving people poking through the rubble, and there he wrote these five poems. And they're beautifully composed. The first four poems, which are the first four chapters, the chapter divisions are good in the book of Lamentations. The first four are acrostics, which means the first letter of each line corresponds to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And so the first line begins with A, the second line with B, the third line C, but of course in Hebrew letters. We don't see that in our English translations. The third poem, chapter 3, where we're going to be, is three times as long because it's still an acrostic, but the first three lines start with A, the second three lines start with B, the third three lines start with C, and so forth. It would make these poems easier to commit to memory, to Hebrew speaking people. The first poem, chapter 1, is primarily about Jerusalem and what happened to Jerusalem and why it happened. The second poem, chapter 2, is primarily about God and what God did to Jerusalem and why he did it. The third poem, chapter 3, is primarily about Jeremiah himself and his suffering and his response to his suffering. And I think Jeremiah uses himself as an example to the surviving remnant of the people of Judah that are in exile that would read these poems. Let's look here in chapter 3 of Lamentations, and I want us to first read verses 1 through 20. Lamentations 3, verse 1. I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. He has driven me and made me walk in darkness and not light. Surely against me he has turned his hand repeatedly all the day. He has caused my flesh and my skin to waste away. He has broken my bones. He has besieged and encompassed me with bitterness and hardship. In dark places he has made me dwell like those who have long been dead. He has walled me in so that I cannot go out. He has made my chain heavy. He feels like God has trapped him in a dark prison of bitterness and hardship and won't let him escape. He says, even when I cry out and call for help, he shuts out my prayer. He feels like God is not even listening to his prayers. He has blocked my ways with hewn stone. He has made my paths crooked. He feels like God won't let him escape from the misery. He is to me like a bear lying in wait and like a lion in secret places. He has turned aside my ways and torn me to pieces. He has made me desolate. You feel like God is like a lion or a bear to you? God cares about you like a lion or a bear? He says, he bent his bow and set me as a target for the arrow. He has made the arrows of his quiver to enter into my inward parts. You feel like maybe God has set you on his earth as like a target to shoot at? Jeremiah felt like that. I have become a laughingstock to all my people, their mocking song all the day. He has filled me with bitterness. He has made me drunk with wormwood. He has broken my teeth with gravel. And the idea may be that it's like he has asked God for bread, but God has given him stones to eat. He has made me cower in the dust. My soul has been rejected from peace. I have forgotten happiness. He cannot remember what it is like to be happy. So I say, my strength has perished. He is so weary of heartache and hardship. And so has my hope from the Lord. He feels hopeless. Remember my affliction and my wandering, the wormwood and bitterness. Surely my soul remembers and is bowed down within me. Now that is dark, isn't it? That is depression. And you notice that last statement, surely my soul remembers, and he's referring to all of the bad stuff that he has been through and that he's seen and that he still has to deal with. And when his mind is on all of that bad stuff, his soul is bowed with the weight of depression. But verse 21, he turns to speak of the things that he brings to mind that lifts him out of the darkness and despair and fills him with hope. And this, my brothers and sisters, this is what you must realize and this is what you must bring fasten in your minds. Verse 21, he says, "This I recall to mind, therefore I have hope." And I think he's talking about what he's about to say. The thoughts of these truths brighten his world with hope. Let's read it. "The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is Your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I have hope in Him. The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, to the person who seeks Him." To those people with whom God is pleased, to those people who wait for Him, those people who seek Him, God loves them. God is filled with compassion for them. God feels pain at the sight of their pain, and every day, God is at work for their ultimate good. Every morning, He is at work shaping their character, getting them ready for greater blessings, preparing for their future. His loving kindness, His compassion, His faithfulness are intense, and they never fade. Every morning, they are as bright as they've ever been. God will fulfill every promise that He has made to His people. Great is His faithfulness. Jeremiah knows God will come through for His people. He will not let them down. He is 100% reliable 100% of the time. He will save His people from the gloom and the darkness and the pain. It's like this father that I read about, a true story from what I'm told. 1988, in the country of Armenia, parents Samuel and Danielle were sending their boy Armand off to school in the morning. And Samuel, you know, crouched down on the same level as his boy and looked him in the eye and said, "Have a good day at school. And remember, no matter what, I'll always be there for you." And they hugged, and Armand went off to school that day. Hours later, a massive earthquake rocked and devastated the area. Buildings crumbled all over. And in the midst of all the chaos, Samuel and Danielle tried to find out what happened to their son, and they couldn't get any information. And so, and the radio announced there were casualties, were in the thousands. Samuel grabbed his coat and he headed to the schoolyard. He got to the area and Armand's school was nothing but debris. And other parents were standing around crying. And Armand found the place, Samuel found the place where his son's classroom was. And he began picking up a broken beam and moving it off the rubble. He picked up a rock and moved it. He picked up another rock and moved it. And one of the other parents standing by said, "What are you doing? It's no use. You're just going to make things worse." And he tried to pull Samuel away from his work. And Samuel didn't pay any attention to him, and he just kept on digging. And he kept on digging. And as time wore on, one by one, the other parents left. And Samuel just kept on working all through the night. Into the next day, parents came back with flowers and pictures of their children and placed them on the rubble, and Samuel just kept on digging. A firefighter tried to pull him away from the rubble, and he just looked at the firefighter and said, "Won't you help me?" And the firefighter just left him, and he kept on digging. He took hold of another beam, and he moved it out of the way, and he heard a faint cry. "Help." And he listened and he couldn't hear it again, and he began digging furiously. Eventually he heard a muffled voice, "Papa." And he kept on digging until he could see his son, and he brought him out. And there was actually 14 children alive down there that were saved that day because of that faithful father. Our God is a faithful father. And if you are a child of God, though you may be in the darkness, though you may feel trapped and buried in rubble, God will not leave you there. Great is His faithfulness. God will come through. God will bring you out of the darkness and out of the rubble. Nikki, He's digging. And He's coming. Linda, He's digging. He's coming. Wait for God. Great is His faithfulness. He will not disappoint His people. I don't see Frank and Sandy, but they were in my minds. And Vernell, God does not leave His people in the darkness. He'll keep His promises. And then Jeremiah says, "The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I have hope in Him." And he's using language that goes back to when the people of Israel conquered the land of Canaan, and they divided up the land, and each tribe got a portion of land, except for one tribe, didn't get a portion of land. And that was the tribe of Levi, the priestly tribe. The tribe from which came the priest and the assistance of the priest. The tribe that had like a special access to God and could minister in the sacred things and had a special relationship with Him and were to be the spiritual leaders. And God said to the tribe of Levi, "You don't get land, but your portion is Me. You get a special relationship with Me." And Jeremiah discovered that about himself. He realized that, yeah, I don't get money or property or possessions or even a home. I don't get family and friends. I get really hardly anything that in this world, but I have the Lord. The Lord is my portion. I have an almighty, faithful Father who will never cease to love me and will come through on all of His wonderful promises to me. And as Jeremiah brought that to mind and he thought on its implications, it lifted him from the depths of despair and darkness. And he realized that his portion was greater than the portion that anybody else had. No matter how dark, no matter what you have or don't have in the world, if you have the Lord, you have the greatest portion. You have hope. You have a bright and glorious future ahead of you. People whose portion is merely of this world, they're having their fun now. And the meter is soon going to expire, and the ride's going to be over, and they have no more tickets. But if your portion is the Lord, you have hope. What does God require of us? Verse 25 says that we wait for Him, that we seek Him. Verse 25 says, "The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, to the person who seeks Him." Now what does that mean, to wait for God, to seek God? Those almost sound like very different, even maybe contradictory things. To wait sounds like staying put somewhere and looking for God to come to you, whereas to seek Him kind of sounds like not staying put, but moving and trying to make your way toward God. But they're just two different metaphors for the same way of life. To wait, I think, is to keep yourself from certain things that you might desire in order to obtain a greater desire later on. It's like Casa Mexico at lunch this afternoon. If you go there, I would recommend it. And when you sit down, they immediately bring out the chips and salsa. And if you have a chip with salsa, it's probably going to create in you a desire to eat the entire basket. And then another one, because they'll just keep them coming. But the problem is, you could fill up on all the chips and salsa, and then you wouldn't be able to eat as much of the better stuff that would come later. And so you might want to wait. You might want to not fill up on the chips, keep yourself from that desire so that you can have the greater desire. You think of you're waiting in the waiting room at the dentist office, and nobody likes to sit in a waiting room. You'd rather go for a walk or go get ice cream or go get something productive done. But you don't do that, you stay in order to obtain the greater desire of having your teeth fixed. Maybe dumb illustrations. But to wait on God, I think, means that you so conduct your life keeping yourself from certain things you may desire at the moment, keeping yourself from escaping your troubles in wrong ways, from sinful pleasures, from unkindness to others, from compromising what you know is right. You conduct yourself in such a way that if God were to come today, you'd be ready. You live your life in such a way every day that if God came today, you would have His grace and you'd have His favor. It is to live within the boundaries that God has set and told you to live in. It is to walk in His ways, to do things God's way in your life. I think that's waiting on God. And that's what it is to seek God. You know, to seek something is to have the obtaining of that thing as your goal, your objective, your ambition, the thing that it keeps you from going after lesser desires or distractions that would keep you from having that one thing that you are seeking. To seek God is when you make His favor and His friendship and His salvation the goal of your life and the thing that you are after in life. It may be dark, and it may be painful, and you may feel like you've been in the rubble a long time, and it may seem hopeless, but those people who wait for God, who seek God, who have His favor as first and foremost in their life, God will not leave them there. He has too much loving kindness and compassion, and God will come through for them. How about we stand together and sing it? And sing it like we believe it. And as we sing, if we can, if you'd like the prayers of this congregation, or if we can help you to obey the Lord, please come as we sing.